Far, I'm from Hackery in Philadelphia. Hackery is a hackerspace just started up there about 6 months ago. It seems like there's like 9 or 10 spaces just starting up now. So we're just one of the many, you know, younger guys who are pulling stuff together and trying to do the community stuff. Before I get started, they have these really cool random announcement cards. You just like sort of pick one and yell one off. I kind of like it. So anyway, yeah, cell phones, you can turn them off. I turn mine off. That'd be cool. DVD sales of all the talks are also available from previous years, and then this year's are going to be online and things like that. So if you weren't bored enough here, you can watch it again and, I don't know, help you go to sleep at night or something. Whatever works. So I'm going to talk about community fabrication. So I'm going to start with my credentials. I am, as you can see, well prepared to talk about this. I spent years studying this topic, and I didn't just get interested like 3 or 4 months ago and just finally get a fabber like 3 weeks ago. So, you know, it's early morning talk. If you guys fall asleep, don't worry about it. I don't tell anybody. So I'm pretty gung-ho about this stuff, although I haven't had a lot of experience, and frankly, they couldn't find somebody with a lot more experience to talk. So I think probably in the audience in the building somewhere, there's someone more qualified than I to speak. If, you know, catch up with me afterward, correct me on what I've done wrong, yell out during the talk, whatever. Oh, great. See? So they must have just put me in a silly this morning then, so they could I've been downstairs babysitting the hackerspace for the Hackery, so I unfortunately have missed those talks that have happened already. I'm going to talk a little bit about the community aspect of it. It sounds like people have already covered some of this sort of thing. So, what is community fabrication? Fabrication is, you know, building things, fabricating things out of hardware. Community fabrication is the idea you have somewhere you can get to do this that hopefully isn't, you know, a huge cost facility. Hopefully there's an idea of exchanging ideas. It's not, you know, locked behind doors. It's about not only the ability to grab the tools, to use the tools, to learn how to use them, but to bounce around ideas to communicate with people. You know, there's a lot of things that you can do as an individual, but I think people are in the software community are coming to realize pretty hard that when you have other people to bounce ideas off of, when you have other creativity, when you have other angles on the same problem, you can come up with totally new, totally cool solutions. There's some examples of existing projects that are sort of the community facility style of this. South End Tech in Boston is basically a little tech community center. They have a bunch of fabrication tools that I'll get into a little bit later. They're sort of aimed at students. They're aimed at an outreach program. They came out of the MIT Bits and Atoms program. And the idea is, you know, the outreach for getting these technologies for building stuff at the campus was to take it out and, you know, get kids hands-on and teach them some stuff. It turned out to be a really big success. You know, kids come and they build really amazing, cool stuff that you know, people would not have thought of otherwise. And, you know, it's just out in the community. It's like a community center. Sustainable South Bronx is right here in the city. I don't know much about it. If anybody does, feel free to yell out. As far as I understand, it's another one of those centers where it's a community center. It's tied to a school. There's a lot of community colleges around the U.S. in, you know, Michigan, Iowa, places like that, that are building this sort of a fabrication lab at their school. Some of them are doing a really cool job as a community college and, like, making it very accessible to people in the area. Some colleges, you know, not so much. There's a bigger barrier to entry. But that's another set of the sort of, you know, in the community, out there just playing around. There's also, you know, the commercial versions of this. There's Tech Shop out in California. They're building, like, 8 or 9 new places across the U.S. in Seattle and North Carolina. They're building a couple more in California now. It's like a tool gym. You go, you rent the equipment. I stopped by and I checked out their San Francisco location, and they're pretty cool. Like, it's not, you know, it definitely is a paid gym. It definitely is someplace you're going to have to, you know, put a couple bucks down every month to get into, but, you know, you can get in, you can do stuff. There's a community aspect, there's lounge areas, people are really friendly, people are really helpful. There's Crucible, there's a lot of little random places that sort of fit into this but are not coming at it from a fabrication end, but are coming at it from a craft end. There's woodworking shops all over the place. There's places that do ceramics, things like that all over the place. To me, these all sort of fall into the fabrication chunk of things. Like, yeah, maybe they're not making things out of plastics. Maybe they're not making high-tech stuff. Maybe they're just making stuff to sell on Etsy. But they're still making stuff. There's a knowledge base there. There's skills there. And there's the idea that, like, hey, bouncing ideas off, working around, we can do stuff better. I think we can pull ideas from all these guys as we pull the hacker aspect into it. And as we start to look at, like, okay, well, what can we mess with? What can we tear apart and rebuild? And what can we, like, you know, figure out? So for the modern Fab Lab, there's sort of like four main style of tools that it really kind of takes all of them together to make a really sort of like, you know, critical mass. One is the laser cutter, plasma cutter, water jet cutter. They're basically, it's a sheet metal cutting. You get a substance and then you can cut designs out of it, out of a flat, you know, a flat thing. And then of course you can stack those, you can roll them, you can deform them other ways. But the you know, cutting of a sheet surface is like tool zero. CNC machines for cutting a block of material down are another big thing that it's sort of almost every space needs to have. You know, you get whatever it is, wood, metal, you can use a CNC machine, you can, you know, set up, program things in the machine and it cuts it right out for you. There's a lot of layers, a lot of variety of this. You can get a $5,000 machine from Sears that'll get you started, or you can get, you know, the $100,000 Pro Tool, takes up a whole room. There's a whole range of these things. 3D printers are what I'm interested in. That's basically depositing material to build up a structure over layers. There's a lot of unique problems. It's kind of cool. The other tools, like laser printing CNC or laser cutting CNC machines, like they're sort of, people have been doing that for a long time. There's been a lot of tools like that around. The 3D printers are a new tool that's coming out and just getting accessible. Since the 60s, you could go to Bridgeport and you could buy a mill. Or, you know, for the last maybe 10 or 15 years, you can go out and get a water jet cutter. And, you know, they're out there, they're available. The 3D printers, you know, they're finally getting to the price range where guys can get them and just have one in the basement, or a couple guys can chip in to have one, you know, somewhere where everybody can get access to it. And the last is the electronics end of things, like PCB making, rapid prototyping, having the electronics expert to run the motors, run the electronics. You can build a lot of cool devices with just hardware, but it's the hardware-software combination that really pulls all together. So it's turned out that the expertise in software, the expertise in microcontrollers, soldering, all that stuff, laying traces, electrical engineering, that's become a big part of fabrication. And in Philly, we see a lot of artists who are doing installations coming to take our classes in software, coming to take our classes in, you know, programming, because they have this really cool concept. They've actually built most of the rig, and then they're like, oh, like, I don't know how to run the motors, or like, oh, do I get, you know, an 18-volt or a 16-volt or a 4-volt? Like, they're coming to us to ask those questions, and it's sort of weird that there aren't better resources out there. And of course, you know, we're going to them and we're being like, oh, dude, we're building this really cool thing, but we don't know how to physically make things. So there's a weird cross convergence, at least happening in Philly. And I think that from what I'm hearing from other people, it's happening all over the place. But these are the main tools that that really make a modern style Fab Lab. And this is like the main list here. So the functionality floor, there's a lot of places this can go. Things have been sort of like rolling around. These places are building up. And I think it's finally getting to a critical mass where it's going to sort of shift in one direction or the other. The bare minimum that this technology, mainly the last four tools, are going to cover is going to be basically what we have today. I don't think it's going to fall any lower than this. I think this level of stuff is going to be around, which is you got little groups of guys who chip in to buy a tool. They're specialized. They do just like, oh, this is just woodworking, or oh, we're just metalworking, or we're just welding. There's company, you know, there's company fabrications or university fabrications where it's only the company, it's only the university, you have to be a member to get at it. Which there's several in Philly, which drives me a little crazy. It's for design studios. It's expensive. It's exclusive. This is what we have now in a lot of places. There's very few places where you have the open shop side. Then there's the ceiling. Like, how high could this go? If this, like, shoots off and goes crazy, what would happen? One is, like, fabrication everywhere. It's like, you know, Kinko's. You know, you walk in and you want to park for your blender, and you're just like, hey, give me a park for my blender. They have a file somewhere. You pull it up. Custom-made stuff is really easy. You can just go in and you can just pull what you want. You get your name engraved in everything. You can have your name cut into anything, pulled out of anything. You can make a sculpture of your mom's face for a mug if you want your mom's face on a mug. Recycled, reusable materials. There's a lot of people talking about the potential for the polymers, a lot of the plastic extrusion and 3D printing, or the materials you're doing, you're cutting, or you're CNCing out of, to be totally recyclable. Like, you go and you build something and it breaks. You walk back and you just like drop it in a bin. It behind the scenes, the machine chunks it up into little parts and, you know, combines it with epoxy and pulls it back out. Like what they do with the roads and the macadam. You know, they'll tear up a street, they'll reprocess it, and they'll lay that same material right back down, sort of refresh for more use. A lot of people see that, like, the local fabrication shops make this a possibility because you're not shipping things way far away and way back. Like, you, right there, you can drop it off, wait an hour, and you can just, you know, chop up your coffee mug and then have a better coffee mug with a nicer design, you know, in a little bit. cheap customization, cheap repair, I think that's done pretty well. The idea that building hardware will be as easy as building software. That you can go in and you can like build something. If it's wrong, you're like, oh, well, who cares? You can just make another one. And that's to me, that's a really powerful idea. I'm kind of a hand tools type guy. I like to build things. I built a lot of my Christmas gifts. I build a lot of stuff for my apartment. And there's a lot of times where I mess things up and I have stuff at a weird angle, things like that. And being a software guy, I'm like, oh, man, I should have measured 3 times instead of just building it. Because as a software guy, I can just build it. And if it doesn't work, well, who cares? It'll take 3 seconds to change it. When you start to get into physical stuff, you know, those rules change. And to shift it more in the direction of you can prototype fast, you can just throw stuff out and pull it back together, you know, I think that'd be an awesome thing to have. Fab in space. This is one of the things that I don't hear people talking about that I think is just damn sweet, is like, we're going to get into space, we're going to need to build things. It's pretty obvious that fabrication technology is going to be a big part. You know, you can't ship every single possible part up to Mars. You're going to need to ship up a box that can make those parts. I really think that we need a backup system that is not on the big blue marble. And I really think that, you know, some of this technology, I have hopes that, you know, one day I'll sell my great game because I worked on that one with a bunch of crazy guys. And now, you know, it's in space. And, you know, when the planet goes out of orbit and gets eaten by the sun or space monsters come, you know, somebody will live on. So my big question with the functionality ceiling is, like, does this come like a Linux users group style, like guys pull together, the girls pull together, people pull together, they just make a space? Or is it going to be like Kinko's? Is some big company going to go out and say, like, oh, I realize there's a market need for this, and fill it? Right now, we're in the space where it could go either way. There's community groups. There's people just, you know, buying the thing and calling their friends over. There's places like, you know, the Hacktree. There's places like New York City Resistor that are buying rep apps, that are buying data homes, that are just making the tools available. There's also places like TechShop, and, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. They're just, their style is they're going to do a company. They're going to make money. And I sort of feel that we're, the next couple of years are sort of going to be a breaking point to see if TechShop can make a, you know, like commercial enterprise or places like that can make a commercial run for it, or if it's going to sort of fall into the community group hands. So I'm going to talk a little bit about 3D printing, because that's something I know at least a little bit about. So, you know, this is basically rapid prototyping by extruding layers of plastic. If someone is talking about a rapid prototyping machine, they're usually talking about like a $60,000 to $100,000 machine. These are the stuff that design studios have, that architectural firms have, that, you know, the big places that do industrial design have in their offices to put out their samples. They're very high precision. The plastics are usually a little bit more rugged. They get a lot of use. They cost a lot to maintain. These systems are really close. If you want to, you know, make something out of a new material, you want to experiment with chemical materials, things like that. These systems, a lot of times, they won't support it. If you jam it up because you're trying some new plastic that you invented, they're just going to tell you, like, oh, well, you know, it's not covered under your warranty. You have to pay for the repair, stuff like that. The next step down is, like, the 3D printers. This is starting to get in, like, hobbyist affordability, although it's really, you know, the high end of that. Strata Dimension DST, as I understand, is sold out for, like, the next 2.5 years, 3 years. They're making them as fast as possible, but people are buying them up just as fast. Z Corporation, I don't know much about their machines, but it's another one of the desktop models. You know, it comes with their software. You're using their plastic. 3D Systems, same idea. Like, it's in a box, you know, one-touch solution type of thing. You just drop your CAD models and drop them in there, and they deal with maintenance. They deal with that stuff. Below that is, like, the do-it-yourself level, fabrication stuff. There's Fab at Home. There's RepRap. There's Clanking Machine. Clanking Machine is going to be the lowest. That's, like, in theory, you can build a Clanking Machine for, like, $300 to $600. And, you know, that's just basically you get the raw parts, you build it yourself. That project is still coming together a little bit. It's nearly there, and it's going to be out soon. Fab at Home, they just put out the Generation 2 machine. They have a box. It has a couple syringes that are extrude material. It lays down layers, you know. It's not as precise as the huge commercial machines, but, you know, you can put anything you want in there. You can try new materials. You can try doing things like replacing the head with a printer head because you want to print different chemicals. You can, you know, guys have refit it with, like, a candy fabric style melter, so they can, like, put in a substance and then melt it down rather than extruding a substance on top of layers. Really, you know, easy to open up and mess with. And RepRap is the same way. RepRap's goal is to make a machine that'll replicate itself. Same sort of thing, you know. It's a simple parts. All the parts should be made out of the same plastic they make. They actually did, like, replication 0, They took one rep wrap and they made a second rep wrap, made all the plastic parts for it. They had to cut down the metal and do a little bit of the engineering work a little differently, but you know, a rep wrap can basically make itself at this point. So the 3D printer's dream of where this could go, the story goes also with this floor ceiling thing, is world domination. Like, this could be the thing that saves everybody. Green technology, face down mass production with localized production, and it would be cheap and easy to produce here. Get us into space, sustainable local production of goods, like local economy, having the guy making the stuff a couple blocks away instead of across the planet. All that sort of, feel good type stuff. Teach our children to wash our clothes, shave our cats. Just, solve all the world's problems in one go. And this is what a lot of the guys are talking about, and I think it's out there. That could happen. That could be what I think there's a good case for that. And I think that's what people talk a lot about. What I'm sort of interested in is more of what's happening now. 3D printing is a little bit difficult to use. It's really cool. You can make some really good stuff with it, but it's not trivial. It's not you just press a button and stuff pops out. You have to, you have to mess with syringes. You have to mess with the plastics. Stuff doesn't print right the first time. You have to go back and try again. It's not just totally simple stuff. You do need technical skill to run this stuff. The software is a little wonky. Sometimes you have to go in and look at the math and figure out what's going on with the pads. Why isn't it connecting? You can press the connect button, it doesn't work. Okay, well, fire up the debugger, hit a couple breakpoints. Okay, well, this is what's wrong. It's not there yet. There's a lot of work that's going into it still. It's not really something everybody needs. This isn't really a blender that people are going to use every day. A lot of people have talked about fabricators in every home, and there's a chance that could work out. I'm not foresighted enough to see that, but it seems like this is more of a technology you're going to use once in a while and random, one-off type stuff that isn't going to be for everybody. Not everybody has a milling machine in their house, not everybody has a lathe in their house, not everybody has wood cutting materials, but they're really great to have. You can do awesome stuff with them. They're fantastic technologies, but they're not turning the world around. It is just getting traction. Like I said, the fabrication stuff, they're building software now. On the mailing list, for Fab at Home, they were just hey guys, let's make this cross platform. And I'm like, yeah, it's probably a good idea. Not Windows only, please. So it's still at a stage where you can get in and you can steer the technology. And that's part of the reason why I'm interested myself, is that I'd like to get in and I'd like to push this towards being open. I'd like to push this towards accessibility. I'd like to make this stuff available, or help make this stuff available. Either way the technology goes, at least, I'm sort of pushing in one direction, I guess. This might go big, it might go home. People compare it to, let me go back one. People like to make comparison to computer technology in the 60s. We're looking at it right now. It's the geeky guys with their little clubs. There's going to be one in every home. People underestimate the power of it. People underestimate the ubiquity. That's the model that a lot of people like to talk about. It's the homebrew computer club in 1960. And, when I actually signed up for this talk, that's what I thought too. In the last month and a half or so of messing with things, I'm thinking it's more like Linux in the mid-90s. It could really be something, but it's not there. There's a lot of talk. There's a lot of hype. But frankly, you're not seeing Linux desktops on every machine these days. It runs the backbone of the internet. There's a lot of small devices coming out there, but it's not, it's a little different. It's a little more technical. It's a little harder to deal with. It's a little, takes a little bit more to dig into. It takes a little more skill to make it happen. That's sort of the overview of 3D systems. I'm realizing now I'm burning through this really fast, so this may be a really short talk. So I've been using Fab at Home. That's the system that the Hactory decided upon. We looked at RepWrap. We really liked it. Evan Malone actually came and spoke at one of the events in Philly, and we talked to him, and he was pretty gung-ho, and, we made the hard decision and decided to go with Fab at Home. Fab at Home only officially has a Windows framework. Yeah. I was actually on the bus coming down here, exchanging emails with people about hey, let's make the open source version of the framework the official framework. Let's move everything into Boost. Let's move everything so it's cross-platform. It's really weird to see this technology that's cutting-edge next-generation technology, talking a lot about openness, making source code available, and then it only runs on one platform. So it's software and hardware are a bit obstinate. It is a little bit hard to get it to do what you want it to do. It's not, you know, it's not just print this device. You have to home the machine. You have to set up your coordinates. You have to make sure that your models are right. There are times where you load a model, you set it up, and, you know, it won't go. So you have to go in and you have to figure things out. Like, it's not trivial. But to make up for that is there's an awesome community behind it. The guys that are, you know, doing these projects, the guys on these mailing lists, the guys in the fabrication forums on, you know, the 15 fab sites out there are absolutely awesome. It's a lot like I said, I think it's a lot like the Linux community. Like, they're rabid lovers of the technology. And you ask any question, and somebody will get back to you with an answer. Somebody will figure something out. You have obscure, weird stuff, and everybody's right there chipping in, giving you a hand, like trying to help you figure stuff out. It is a little expensive to get rolling. Fab at Home, I think a little more so than the RepRap, and both of those more than the clanking machine. You know, you have to put down some money to get one of these and to get it going, or you have to put in quite a bit of time building things. And there is definitely a barrier to that I would like to see lowered. I don't think it's going to fall overnight, but I do think, you know, every revision they do of a machine, they cut a few things down, they simplify it, they figure a few things out. And frankly, these things are sweet. Like, I'm complaining about them a little bit, but it's really awesome. You go in and you set up a 3D file and you the thing comes out. We're talking with a couple people about what uses we can put this to in our last video. I don't have anything useful to do with this. I just like making stuff. So I'm like making just random things for the hell of it because, you know, that's what I enjoy. We lost video, I guess. So, since I don't know about RepRap, I want to open it up. Is there anybody here use RepRap? Is anybody familiar with RepRap systems? Okay, cool. Say again? And is it working up to expectations? What do you see it doing in the next year or two? How are things going?
Cool.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, all of these except standard STL output file. There's an open source program called Art of Illusion, which is Java-based. It runs pretty well on several different platforms. But really, you know, it's pretty easy to operate. You can actually do Blender 3D, too, if anybody has Blender experience. You can tweak some parameters in Blender to make it a little easier to use, and you can build the models in Blender. Art of Illusion, both of those are free. 3D Studio Max, things like that, will all put out output STL files that are read in. It won't warn you if your design is too complex or things like that. It'll just generally try to make it. But you do need to have sort of like blocky, simplified designs. You can't do anything too fine-grained with these machines because their precision isn't there yet. They're still, you know, still being worked on. Usually millimeters, like, you know, plus or minus half millimeter, things like that. I think the fab at home, the best I've gotten is like plus or minus half millimeter. I think people have gotten it more accurate, but people have more experience than I. So. Sure. Sweet. Yeah, definitely, and you know, it's definitely not a perfect technology. It's still growing, and I think that's, you know. So your Creek cubes, did you design that like just out of STL files and threw it together? And you said 18 hours?
Yeah.
Sweet.
Has anyone done an actual cost-benefit analysis? Has anyone actually done a cost-benefit analysis on how much energy it uses? Like, if you compare like a RepRap to, say a RepRap uses 100 joules a day, if you compare it to a battery, then it uses a megajoule, but it puts up a million a day, and then it costs 10 megajoules to charge. chiller.
Right.
You're still talking about an order of magnitude more energy streams on the rec craft.
Yes.
Versus even though you're not shipping them, because the demand for the stuff is still there. And if everyone gets four dollars to get the rec craft,
right.
Then you're the energy you're playing for the thing.
Yeah, exactly. I've seen, you know, I've actually talked with guys and done some back of the envelope calculations, but I don't think there's been any real official study on this. And the general agreement is also like this stuff really isn't green right now. Like there's the potential, there's that like pie in the sky, we're gonna get there, and there's totally a chance. That's what I'm voting for, but it's not there yet. A lot of the materials they're using are kind of nasty materials. You read the MSDS sheets on this, and it's like, I don't really know if I want to be breathing this in too much. I'm gonna turn on a fan. You know, they're really cool stuff, but it's that's something that needs to be worked on. No, once they harden, they're not too bad. And like, I don't think a little bit of material from like taking a shot of shot glass or like, you know, eating off of something. You know, I printed things, then I print some chocolate thing, and I'll eat the chocolate because I use chocolate for test printing. But it's the sort of thing where like, if you're making 40 million of them, or if there really is one of these shops on every corner, like what happens or what does that add when everything comes out? Very cool. Very cool. Excellent. So basically when you're done, you can chop back up and it'll biodegrade, and you need to be able to process it. Sweet. Oh, that's excellent, man. Yeah. I think there's potential. This is exactly what like my interest in it is because I don't think it's a one-shot solution. I think that right now the technology is growing, and I think that the hacker community should get interested in steering it because, you know, Linux is an awesome tool. It's out there. Anybody can grab it. It has given a lot of power to a lot of individuals. It is full, you know, it has leveled the playing field. Like, you can learn stuff. You can get access to knowledge. You can get access to tools, you know, using Linux that you can't get otherwise. You know, Art of Illusion, Blender, things like that. They're tools on top of tools. You know, like, I think a lot of these other 3D programs wouldn't have happened unless somebody looked at Linux and was like, oh, dude, you can actually pull this off. And for me, like, that is what I see my interest, and I hope to get that interest sparked in other people. So you're like, all right, the technology's here, and we gotta, like, you know, we gotta lean it in the direction that is cool for us, that gives us the ability to make what we want, to figure out what we want, to play with what we want, rather than, like, letting it just naturally lean towards, you know, some commercial system where you have to ship it off to Iowa to get repaired if you play with something you're not supposed to play with. So, I don't have much more slides. I really wasn't expecting I would have a whole hour for a talk, so I didn't plan a whole hour for a talk. I was wondering, you know, if people want to hang out and talk about this. Does anybody else have comments or ideas on this? You want to grab the mic, dude, since you're in the back?
I was wondering about your capability. Three questions. Do you have a legal structure, and what's the thing that...
Okay. We do not have a legal structure. We are umbrellaed under a local nonprofit. We're trying to figure out, frankly, if we want to do an LLC or if we want to go for the nonprofit status and do like a 501c3. Nobody's going to really make any money off of this. Like, I don't think there's potential. It's just a lot of fun. but there is, you know, even internally an argument whether we want to officially do that and say, like, okay, officially in the rules of how we operate, it's nonprofit, or just do an LLC and expect to never make any. The coolest thing we've made, we haven't made very many cool things, to tell you the truth. We've only had a 3D printer about 2 weeks now, so we've been doing a lot of test prints. We've made, blocks of letters. Craftmark is actually really cool. It's in King of Prussia, like a half an hour away. So I had a box of Craftmark demo materials on my desk at home that I can't play with because I'm here this weekend. But it's really nice that it's small enough that, like, I email the manufacturer. I'm like, hey, dude, you're right nearby. They're like, oh, yeah, you want to play with stuff? Here's a bunch of stuff. Like, next year I will have a much better answer for that question. There's another guy back there that...
You sort of mentioned that you feel that the technology might not be that useful yet. And you talked about making it more accessible.
Yes.
I'm wondering if you have thoughts about what it would take to make the technology more useful, and how they're interested in
it. Yeah, right now there's sort of two things, and one is the software and how sophisticated it takes to use it, I think, is barrier, is the most obvious barrier. And the other is a material science question. There are a bunch of materials people are using, and there's a lot of expansion in other materials. The Fab at Home Wiki has pages of, like, here's an idea of what to make, here I tried it, it kind of worked, here's an idea of what to make, here I tried it, it really worked well. People right now are out there basically, like, pushing out in all different directions on the materials and trying to get fast, easy-to-use materials that can break down. But that is one of the barriers. Like, loading the machines up, getting the materials set up is a little bit of a frustration right now. And the other, actually, is something that people in this room could help with a lot, which is software and firmware. A lot of tools for this were existing tools for 3D, for 3D stuff like Blender or Art of Illusion, or their homebrew software that was written within the last year. That is, a lab got some money, they got a grad student or an undergrad student, and they set the software up. So there's, it's all right there. It's all right on the surface. You don't have to dig very far to find interesting things to work on in the fabrication stuff. I'm going to complain a little more about software because I'm a software guy, but, the user interface for Fab at Home is just, it's really a kind of a pain to use right now, and there's three or four people working on it trying to clean it up, but, you load a file, then you load another file, and then you're not sure which loads or which menu it was. There's times where I hit print, and the print button is grayed out. There's no explanation. There's the status bar at the bottom doesn't say anything. It's just that button just doesn't work anymore. So I close the program down, I start it back up, or I, throw open the debugger and start to step through to see where it's, not working. So there's, if people want to dig in, this is a really cool thing to work on. And, like, your result isn't just something that you can throw up on SourceForge or Fresh Meat. Like, your result is a thing you can put on your desk and be like, oh, yeah, that's a thing. So.
How long do the 3D printers actually last before? Like, how many prints can you make with them before they start to break down? And is that, like, a concern with guys doing test prints or whatnot?
Yeah, it's not really a concern. The concern is usually, like, your material supply. We have, like, little 8-10-ounce cans of material that it's probably, like, I don't know, $15 of material or something like that. So making, and it takes 8 hours to make a print, or it takes 6 hours to make a print of something that's moderately complex. So, like, the bigger issue isn't, is the machine going to wear out? The bigger issue is, like, how bored am I getting right now? Because, you start a print, and I'll go tinker around the hackerspace, clean things up, put things in drawers, make little labels, solder together a proto board, I come back, and it's still printing. I'm like, man, I'm not going to sit here all day. So I go off, and I leave, and I come back, and it froze on an error a half an hour ago, and, I have to restart. So these machines are going to last a long time. They're just built on standard stepper motors, and a lot of them have syringe units that are replaceable. You can pull them out if they get clogged up. You can clean them. You can throw them out and get a new one because they're just small. And then the chassis around it, those things will last for a long time. But the bigger thing is, like, basically the weight and, again, dealing with loading, unloading, things like that. Yeah. You can buy, so the big barrier on that is what size you want. You can buy from Sears a little $3,000 unit that can do about maybe 10 inches by 12 inches, And it's great, you know, you just go to Sears.com, order it, it comes in. It actually, from what I've heard, has halfway decent software. If you want like a table size, you're going to get to about $5,000. And that's going to be the cutting system without a background table, without the bench base, without things like that. You want all that, it's going to get to about $7,000. I was looking just the other day at getting a, 48 by 30 cutting surface. I was like, oh, wow, $5,000 is cheap. But that's just the machining on the top. You really have to have a very stable base to run these on because the way the motors like slew back and forth, they tend to pull and shake things apart. You know, you can throw together a wooden table, but it's probably going to pull itself apart from the movement in a few months, and you're going to get very, you know, much less exact cuts out of it. So again, like $7,000, it isn't much, but is it really something that you want in your own garage, or you want a bunch of people having in their own garage? You know, or is it better to pool it together? You know, get some space somewhere so people can get to, and like, you know, pool your money, pool your effort, and, you know, centralize. I would love to get, I have to make sure I write that down afterwards, catch up with me, because I want to grab that. There's two projects that are like leaning in that direction. Two things that makes me think of. One is in one of the Terry Pratchett books, they talk about doors, and like all you need for a door to be successful is a fire. So the fire you can make a forge, with a forge you can make tools, with tools you can make better tools, and give them like 2 years in fire, and a door can make anything. And that's very much the same idea, like bootstrapping up. There's a program that is based on doing that out of old car parts, and it's centered on getting that technology into Africa, where they have scrap stuff that comes down and gets torn apart by hand. And same idea, you start with a drum brake, and you start with just setting a fire under a drum brake, and then you get some of the softer metal from the cars, and you work your first set of tools, and then from there you can build more. So like that idea is, you know, it's an awesome idea, and it's not dead, it's still floating around. Yeah. Anybody else? I thought I saw hands up.
So if I don't have like 3,000 foot maybe cutter or something like that, do you recommend the school cost or any parts that you have to avoid?
Yeah, okay, so the Hackery in January just got our space donated. The nonprofit that we're umbrellaed under said, we have a third floor, it's completely trashed, why don't you go up there? And I had $50, that's all we had. And our decision at that time is we decided to build a vacuum former first. We got a vacuum former and a jigsaw so we could, you know, make plastic forms and then cut them out and sand them down. From there, in that regard, our next tools are going to be a scroll saw, and we just got a chop saw. So, I think a jigsaw is a nice first step tool. A lot of places have chosen, a lot of guys who are doing their own home shops have chosen to go first with a non-motorized CNC machine, and then they build motors onto that. And like that is, they're learning how to use the technology, they're building it themselves, and they're doing it on the cheap because they don't have much else. So yeah, I would say scroll saw probably would be one of a few good options to go with. Anybody else? Yeah, I spent quite a bit of time like looking at the different options for that. And frankly, what I came down to is we don't have the time to do that. There's a lot of good projects, and there's several websites out there that are centered on the do-it-yourself CNC style. And it's totally doable. You can just go out and get the machine. You can buy the engine parts. There's software. There's tons of examples. There's guys that do everything from like designing their own boards through. You can buy like pre-built motorboard sets that'll run off something like an Arduino or just off a old parallel port. So you can, like the Make controller I know a couple weeks ago, you just use the Make motor controller. There definitely is a good potential for doing that. It's pretty straightforward, but it's a big investment in time. One of the things that I, again, coming from a software background, like, I was sort of overwhelmed at the time it takes to make some stuff. Like, with software, if I know what I'm building, I can just sit down and I can do it. With mechanical stuff, I severely underestimated the difference between, like, knowing how to do something and actually having it done. You know, there's a, to me at least, there's a bigger barrier. You know, like, if I know software, it comes out. Mm-hmm. If I know a mechanical thing, I do it and it's wrong. I build a second one. I measure four times. Like, there's a big time commitment getting into building the stuff yourself. The PCB maker, yeah. Yeah, I think there's sort of like you were saying, there's like a stepping stone where if you build one, it'll make it easier to build the others. You know, I don't see them converging like into one machine, and I don't see them totally solving the problem of making the others. That's, you know, one of the things we talked about was when we had a vacuum former, we looked at the fat at home, and there's a plastic shell, and we're like, oh, we could like vacuum form the shell or something like that. Like, what tools can you use to make other tools? They definitely, you can bootstrap probably. If you did it the right way, you could build one tool and pull all the parts from that to build the other. But I think that would take actually a lot of effort to pull off. So. Yeah, rep wrap is very cool like that. Fab at Home has done, they haven't done PCBs, but they've done batteries, and they've done mechanical, basically the dielectric metals that will bend when you apply voltage to them. And there's a couple projects where they would lay down a plastic case, then they would lay down their various metal layers, and then case the top in plastic. And then, you know, you apply electricity to it, it'll bend in turn. Doesn't directly apply to the project itself, though. So, one of the things that I found kind of hard as I'm getting into this, because like I said, I'm not super qualified to be talking or anything, I'm just starting playing with stuff myself, is a lot of stuff is out there and done, but it's not on the internet yet. Again, like, I'm just like, oh, if it's out there, it's going to be on a wiki somewhere. There's not. I'll find some guy email, and he's like, oh, I did these seven things. I'm like, why does no one know about this? Because that would be so useful if I had found out. So I spend a lot of time in correspondence digging out information about, you know, things that are out there but aren't really publicized yet or aren't just, you know, right at the end of a quick web search. All right. Any other questions? Okay. I don't think it has an interpreter. I haven't dug into the firmware much. I've mostly been looking at the PC side software for it. One of the things we have been talking about is doing a central dispatcher. There's RepRap, there's Fab at Home, there's several of these machines all aimed at the same goal, but they're all writing separate silos of software. It's like, all right, guys, why don't we make, you know, take a good software design, make a central dispatcher. Your tools all know how to talk to it. Your interpreters of the STL files into tool paths all know how to send tool paths down. That's one of our goals. Again, this stuff is, like, super fresh. Like, I was on the bus, again, writing emails to people being like, hey, guys, why doesn't RepRap and Fab at Home get together to write software? You know, and that was yesterday. I haven't checked to see if they've replied yet. So this stuff is, like, it's right at the surface. Like, again, all the interesting problems are right there, easy to grab a hold of, and, you know, could use some help. So. All right. If there are any more questions, I'm going to call it good. Thanks for coming. I hope it wasn't too uninformed. So.
I'm an industrial design student. So, like.